Welcome to Becoming Church, the podcast where we discuss how the message and movement of Jesus is not just about becoming Christians, but about becoming the church. I'm your host, Kristen Mocker-Young, and my guest today is Kim Stewart, author of the book, Starve for Jesus and Other Jobs I Quit. Now, please don't tell the other guests on the 70-ish episodes that we have here on the Becoming Church podcast. I love them all very, very much. However, this is probably the most fun I have ever had in recording one of these episodes. So I don't want to oversell it at all, but I know that you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Actually, right now, if you can think of someone who could really use a good laugh or maybe need some joy in their life, would you share this episode with them? You can send it to them through social media. You can drop them the link. You can text it, add it to your own social media stories. But if you know someone who could use some joy, this is going to be a conversation, one little hour that you could gift them to help them kind of look at God's bigger story and see where his sense of humor is at work and is at play. All right, let's get into my conversation with Kim Stewart. All right, Kim, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to Becoming Church.
I'm so honored to be here. Thank you for the very kind invitation.
Yes, we were just chatting a little bit about, you know, both being Midwestern girls, even though now I'm in Charlotte. You're still a Midwesterner, right?
I still am. I left for a bit. We lived in Costa Rica and Houston. I lived there for a little bit. Minneapolis, lived in Nebraska. Those are both Midwestern.
Ma'am, you lived in Costa Rica and you went back to the Midwest?
Oh, I sure did.
Help me make it make sense. I don't understand.
I mean, I loved Costa Rica. It was a lovely spot. We lived there right after Mark and I got married. Okay. We both double majored in Spanish and something else, and it just never worked to live in a Latin American or Spanish-speaking country during college. And so after we got married, we had a spot before he started the next phase of grad school and I started teaching. And so we packed our bags and headed down to the San Jose area. And it was wonderful. We taught English. We should definitely have not been so conscientious because we were making approximately 14 cents a day. Yes. And we should have just not worked. Like if we'd known how much work was to come, we were trying to be so diligent. We should have just traveled. But it was great. Yeah. We loved it. We were there for about 5-6 months and then headed home to continue our real lives. So it was
I
good.
Love that. Yeah, we that's loved so it. Fun. Looking back, that's something that I kind of keep realizing and I want to instill in my girls too is like live your life before you get married. Not that it's over, not that like getting married is over, but there's just, you can do so many more things, you know? And I wish I had traveled more. I wish I'd done more stuff.
Yeah. I would even say even in early marriage is a great time to cut and run. Yeah. I mean, we were married and no children and we love our children, but it gets a little bit more complicated to uproot. We had a great time. It was so fantastic. It was great for our early, I mean, we really left the church basically and got on a plane. And so we had no friends. Okay. Down in Costa Rica, we lived in this little Quonset hut. We knew like a couple Canadians. And then we worked at this school that took 80 hours to get to every day. And so we had no friends, which means when Mark and I were kind of working out the kinks of our relationship and having our first, you know, total knockdown track house, for example, hypothetically, I had no one to call. This was the era of no WhatsApp, and I surely had one calling card that we would put money on. And I called my parents once a week. So if I was arguing with my husband, there was nowhere to go. So we really had to figure out different communication styles and different ways of moving through the world because there was no other choice. So I do recommend that to my kids. Like, go figure out some of your stuff because it's really kind of beautiful to have a lot of those things in place before more hard things hit. So I called my mom. In fact, I remember calling my mom one time on the Sunday. It's like Pioneer Times. You get the mail from the Pony Express once every 6 months. And I called her and I remember I was like kind of kvetching a little bit about something that Mark had said or done. And she said, oh, leave and cleave. Love you, honey. Hung up.
Stop it.
She was absolutely like,
go with God.
Totally. Totally. She was like, sounds like something you two will have to work out. So best thing ever. That's the best gift ever. Not, oh, I'm going to really sit with you in this and enable your own total selfishness. She was like, yeah, sounds like you're wrong and he's wrong. Better go talk about it. So anyway, a lot of distance between can be a really good thing.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, forced grow up, if nothing else.
Total right? Forced. Yeah.
Okay. And I guess if you're married, it's time to grow up then.
Yeah, for sure. Pastime maybe. Mm-hmm.
Well, you share, I love that story. You share lots of stories in your book and we're going to get into it. I've got your book right here, all marked up and stained with my tears.
Oh my goodness.
We'll get into that too. But it's called Star for Jesus and Other Jobs I Quit. And so something that I stumbled upon, Kim, when you were promoting the book is that you said one of the things that you learned is that less is more when it comes to hairspray. That was in your like, promo video.
Starting in with theology from the top. Yes.
All this, these, I'm here for the hard-hitting important things, okay? All I could picture was my, like, sophomore year self with the world's largest curling iron. I would put them in my bangs, curl my bangs, and then I'm telling you, they were this big. I would spray it to high heaven.
Totally.
Pull the curling iron out and then do this very careful, like,
detach.
Careful separation.
Yeah.
So that they were all exactly the same different parts.
Yeah. I like how even these years later, Kristen, your hands, this is muscle memory. You were, even today,
I got it.
You just knew how to do the separation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had this thing going on. I can still do the wrist flip, you know, volume. Yeah. I'm much older than you are. And so we really worked for height. And also I remember a lot of clouds of aerosol. I can taste that in my mouth right now when I think of that. Salon Selectives, Aquanet, maybe some White Rain if we're feeling it. So much. There was so much. It was crunchy hair.
Oh, see, I was big on the Aussie. Everything was purple.
Oh, yeah, Aussie. Like, yeah. Oh, I can smell that too when I think of it.
That was what we, Like, we didn't need perfume. Body spray? No, thank you. I have enough hairspray right now. Just in my bangs. You'll know when I'm coming and you'll remember me when I leave. Okay.
I have some questions in retrospect about how we thought that was necessary. Like that's a lot. We weren't all living in gale force winds. It was not permanent hurricane conditions. I feel like we could have let a little of that slide. Also, I am married to a man who would now say, I actually don't want there to be percussion in your hair when I give you a hug. Like, why did we think that? It's off-putting.
I'm saying it's the natural. I know you can't tell, but I have naturally worked like wavy hair like yours. I think it's that. I think it's just control. Just trying for the control. What we could.
Yeah. It's control. It was a control situation. Yeah. I mean, I've got that in spades, not just with my hair. Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense.
Well, when I heard you say this, that less is more when it comes to hairspray, I immediately was like, okay, I'm going to play a game with Kim. This is how we're
going
to start. Okay. So this is what we're going to do. So rapid fire.
Okay.
I'm going to say a word to you. And you, less of this or more of this? Less or more?
That's okay.
You said less hairspray. So I'm going to throw you a word. Less or
I
more.
I say whether I like, I would like less or more.
If you want
in
less
my
or
life.
More. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This is so fun. All right. I love it.
Ready? Okay. Salt. Ready.
Less.
Coffee creamer.
Less.
Mayonnaise.
Less.
Okay. Raisins and cookies.
Oh, never, never, never.
Listen, I was going to tell you there's no wrong answers on here, but there really are. So good job. You're doing well so far. Okay. Nicknames.
Oh, more.
Perfume.
Less.
Lipstick.
I mean, midway. As I age, more. Define those disappearing lips.
All right, we got a few more. Flashy clothes.
Less.
Okay. Christian influencers.
Oh, golly. I need to meet him first before I decide.
Fair enough. Pop culture references in Christian spaces.
Okay, now that is a complicated question, Kristen. If you do it well and it's actual laughter, yes. But if it's dumb church laughter, I mean, more. If it's dumb church laughter, less. You need someone to hold you accountable.
Yes, fair. All right, last one. This is the hardest. Gold stars.
Oh, bless. Don't need him anymore.
Good. And that is
that was so great. I love it.
That was fun, right?
Totally.
I usually just jump into it with people, and you inspired me. So now I'm like, I got to play more games. This was fun. I like this.
I love it. That was great.
Well, I didn't realize that Star for Jesus was actually your 9th book, but it's your first nonfiction novel. So how did you know that, like, okay, this is time to make the switch and write something very, very different than the other 8 books that you've already authored?
Yeah. So I wrote a bunch of novels, 8, I think. There's one that I buried under a tree that will never see the light of day, and that one didn't get a barcode, but if we count them, then we've got 9, but 8 in print. And yes. I loved that. I loved that gig. I wrote, I always said they were Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan books. So kind of some banter and some chemistry, but not sugary. So I didn't really fit necessarily with the Christians because the Christians got nervous with pretty much everything, I found.
Yeah, they tend to do that.
Yeah. If it's not pioneer romance, I'm talking about publishing companies, not normal. And then for the mainstream market, I was way too clean. So just not enough. There's not raunchy anything.
Mm-hmm. Not spicy.
So I loved that time. I did it for years and years, and I loved those. I still love those books. Those have been a sweet part of my life, and I've learned so much. And I think a lot of what I learned about storytelling comes into this book. But this book is all true stories. So in some ways, this was easier to write because I felt a different freedom with this release than I ever have with a book release. And I think that's because these all happened. You might not like the plot or the movement or all the other things we pick apart with fiction, but that's okay because these really were my life. This really is all true. And so I feel a different kind of security just saying, well, you can take it or leave it, but these are really true stories. And then I also love the heartbeat, kind of the thread I pull throughout, which is the idea of grace. I think there was grace in every book I wrote. In fact, that has been such an important part of my inner life for so long that when I look at those books, there's always at least a few moments where grace wins.
Do you think you did that intentionally or you just realized it after?
Most times it was intentional because I feel like even fiction, even a novel needs to bring you to a new spot of what you understand about the world. And I do it predominantly through humor, and you should probably laugh or cry a couple times in each book. But in general, I really kind of use humor to break down some defenses. But the point is usually to get to what does it look like to steep your toes in grace. And so it's kind of fun to look at books that are old now and think, oh, I was already kind of untangling that for myself. So,
yeah, I love that. Well, I read Star for Jesus. I was on a staff intensive. We took a couple of days to do this staff intensive. I think I'm the only one calling it that. Everybody else is like, we went on a staff retreat. And I'm like, that was not my experience. That was a staff intensive.
Words
matter.
But
we took a break. Yes. We took a break and we went to the beach. And I storied that I was reading this and I was so excited. And then I immediately storied again, and I was like, JK, invitation rescinded, because I started crying on the beach during the introduction. During the introduction.
Oh, that's such a compliment to me. That's very kind, because that means you were entering in.
Oh, my gosh. It was one of those things, like one of the other pastors on staff, I was underlining, and he thought he was making a joke and being funny, and he's like, oh, what's that you're underlining? And I was like, well, actually, it's everything that I think I don't need to hear and I'm trying not to hear, but the Lord clearly wants me to hear. And so it's right here in this book. And
awesome.
He was like, okay, I'm gonna get a Frisbee and go for a
I'm going to go retreat. You stick with your intensive. I'm going to go retreat. That's awesome.
Yes. So for you, because like you said, these were personal stories. What part of this book ended up being the most tender for you?
I will tell you, the hardest part for me to write was the most familiar story. So, and that's okay. A funny thing that we do as writers. I think oftentimes if there's a really important story in our family history or in our, you know, a story that we've revisited over and over that's really important to us, those are the hardest to write, in my opinion. And I think it's because okay. they hold so much weight that we want to do right by them. So the story for me was when there's a chapter in the book about when I was run over by a car when I was 2 years old. And that story is a very pivotal moment in our family life. It was basically the moment where my dad he had been wrestling with God for a while and saying, I'm done with this. I don't even know if you're out there. And if you are out there, you better tell me. Because I'm sick of doing the dance. I'm not going to go to church anymore. I'm not going to think about you. This is it. And God answered in technicolor relief, like with fireworks, for my dad who speaks that language. And so I have revisited that story so often. For years, little ladies in church would come up to me and say, "You're the miracle baby. I prayed for you." My mom has told me this story from her perspective. When I had a 2-year-old myself, I spent a lot of that year a little weepy because I understood in a totally new way what that would feel like from my mom's perspective. And so that it's a 46-year-old story that I have told and heard and held so long. It is tender. That's a funny thing because you'd think that the more you revisit something, the less tender it would be or the less emotional. That hasn't been the case for me. I think because as I hold that up into the light with different years and different seasons in my life, it holds more weight because it was such an important time. And so that's probably the one that was most – I avoided it. It's not at the end of the book. It's probably closer to the middle or the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I just avoided that stinker forever and thought, I'm not writing that. It's too, I don't know how to do right by it. It's too big. So do you have those? Do you have those stories yourself that like they're so, if you would ever have to put words to it in a 2,500 word block, it would feel like this isn't enough. This needs its own thing.
Well, for mine, I know. So I'm actually, surprise, surprise. I'm actually working on a book proposal right now.
Awesome.
Announcement.
I'm not surprised. That's awesome. are you outing yourself right now? That's the first time you've talked about that on air?
I think it's the first time I've mentioned it on the podcast. Yes.
Oh my gosh. I am inducing. This is a wonderful moment, listeners. You are getting it here first. Oh, I'm so excited to be here for this moment.
About it on my Instagram stories. I think that's it. So yay. Thank
that's
you for being
awesome.
Here for this
congratulations. So great.
Thank you, Megan. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So commercial over. I think for me, the things that feel the most tender are the things that involve other people who may have a different version of the story than I have.
Right.
That are those right now are the ones that I'm like, these are important and I want to tell them, but I know that my version's not the only version. And so how do I do justice to my experience and my perspective and what I learned from it without it, you know, misrepresenting someone else? I think that's what I'm wrestling with right now.
That's a big question for sure. And it is a wrestle. It is. Yeah. I mean, that you are considering the other perspectives and holding them with care tells me it's going to be a great book.
Thank you.
I often, for this book, I vetted something. I mean, I let other people vet. If they were in the story, I would lift the paragraphs where they were, send it to them and say, is this about what you, you know, is there anything objectionable in here? You know, and at this, and at 100% of them, 100% of those people signed off and said, yep, sounds great. Now, I'm sure I mean, my mother has said multiple times, you made us sound like such wonderful people. Aww. I don't think that that's, you're not correct. But I'm just going to take it. And so, I mean, if anything, I've gotten a little bit of that. But in general, people are very honored, I think, when we endeavor to truthfully tell a story. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about what that looks like within a church context. But humility and honesty in a story will smooth over those speed bumps. Absolutely, there's a perspective question, and you won't tell it the same way that somebody else does. And that's okay. That's okay. That's actually really rich soil and a good thing.
Oh, well, thank you. I receive all of that.
Well, I can't wait to read your book. That's awesome.
So Star for Jesus, yes, made me cry a couple times, but it also made me laugh in every chapter. I'm telling you, in every chapter. Oh, so on the flip side, what was your favorite story to tell?
Oh, golly. I mean, by the time, talk to me in a year and a half, Kristen, after you've gone through 5 million drafts of your book, and I'm going to ask you that question, and I'm going to pop some corn and watch how you answer it, because, I mean, if it made it through the cutting room floor, it had to be a favorite. I don't write anymore with the idea of, well, I'll put this in the next book. I don't do that anymore. That is a little too presumptuous, because I've been doing this long enough. I started writing when Mitch, my son, who just graduated from high school, when he was in utero. So it's been about 18 years. And I started – it was a total fluke, by the way. I didn't mean to do this. But it's been long – I've been on this kind of weird – in this weird business long enough that there's really nothing that's guaranteed. And so – If I want to write the best book I can write, I put all of the good stuff in. And then I just trust the God who tells the best stories that he will give me more next time. But I don't, I don't like scurry things away thinking, oh, that's the best story, but I'm not going to put it here. If it doesn't fit at all with the theme or with the, with, you know, what I'm trying to do, obviously I don't plop it in there, but
sure.
I really try to write the best book I can every single time so that I'm not looking back and thinking, what the heck was I doing waiting on that? Get it in there. And these stories change, just like we were just discussing these. As we grow, stories mean different things. So put them in there now, because it'll probably mean something different to you in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. But I will return to you and ask you that very same question and see how you
Listen, everybody listening can just pause. I'm just going to take notes right now. Thank you, Kim, for all of this advice. I appreciate everyone being here for my authorship consultation.
Well, you know how to find. I don't know anything. I mean, listen, we're all fumbling in the dark here. But no, cool. I love talking shop, because it's the weirdest job. And there aren't a lot of spaces where, I mean, more now maybe, but when I started, there was no place where you could get sound counsel and good advice. It's a very individual job where you're mostly in your yoga pants by yourself in a room. But it's outward facing. You're hoping that those words reach a lot of people. So it's a really strange kind of dichotomy. So we're in it together.
Well, let's get into your book. You have it kind of divided into five, I think it's five different sections. And it starts with a good bit of achievement talk. This is an Enneagram safe space. Kim, can you go ahead and tell us what your Enneagram is, even though I already know?
Listen, I bet you think I'm a three, do you?
I was going to guess three or that's what I was going to guess.
Or one.
Based off of all that.
I don't even know. This is another question I don't like. I have read the books. I've discussed with the people. I don't know. I think I'm too contrarian. Maybe that makes me a four, but I've got a lot of achievement in me. I'm a firstborn female, apart from the Enneagram. Yeah. I am a firstborn female. I know all about making lists. I really like making lists and crushing the lists. And I do that in lots of spaces of my life, including my time and relationship with Jesus. He does not play by that rule. And it's taken me a long time. And still my knee jerk is not to remember the complete, overwhelming, relentless grace of God. That's not a knee jerk reaction for me as a human being, because I don't see it anywhere else. So achievement is my mojo. I think a lot of us can identify with that. If we want something, we work for it.
Yes. And that, again, is the second time I cried on the beach. I think it was like chapter one. I was like, well, let's just keep this going. Because, again, coming from staff intensive conversations about who's doing what, and I'm literally like on the floor going, I cannot carry all of this anymore. I cannot do all of these things. And they're like, then don't. And I'm like, but then who will? And I have to, and all of this, right? Mm-hmm. But you have a lot of achievement talk at the beginning about working for gold stars and goals and check marks and lists and all these things. And it is woven throughout the book. But you talk about how wanting to be a get it done person, like a go-getter, actually gets in the way of grace. Can you explain how that works?
We like to attach math to grace. This is what I've decided. We like to decide when we need, that grace just doesn't, it's not enough on its own. So when God says to Paul, actually Jesus says to Paul, my grace is sufficient for you. It's enough. I smile and nod at him and say, that's sweet. But I think you need some of my help. And I do it both ways. I think God needs me to decide who gets grace, right? So there's a little bit of a subtractive quality, like, oh, it's grace for everyone, but not you. Not you. Mm-hmm. Not if you think that or post that or talk about that or yell about that or use your pulpit to wield. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I've got a lot of lists of people who I really don't think need a lot of grace. And then I also add, and I say, thank you, God, so much for this grace that you say is sufficient. I'm just going to put a couple more things on that altar. I think you need a little help. And I'm going to impress you with all the ways that you have made a great decision in loving me. Let me show you why. And the thing is, grace, there is no math. There is no math. It is completely on its own, done. Not just sufficient. It's more than enough, right? Elsewhere in scripture, God talks about grace upon grace. This isn't like chintzy grace. So I think that's the thing. If I'm working so diligently in every other area of my life to, you know, earn my keep, pay my mortgage, make sure I have healthy relationships, there's a lot of effort involved there. When you're lying on the floor at your retreat/intensive, the math at work is work perform equals productivity and advancement. That's how this thing runs.
Yeah.
And it is a total mind bender, a beautiful mind bender over and over to look at what God says about who we are in him and what he has done, paid in full. It's stamped. It's done. You don't need to. It'd be like going to a restaurant, paying the bill, and then leaving, coming back 5 minutes later and saying, listen, I just feel like you want another $50 from me for that pad thai. And so I'm going to leave this. And doing that over and over again, those people would, they'd take your money, but they'd think you were nutso. So it is paid.
Yeah.
It's done. Yeah. And I keep adding, we keep adding or subtracting. And grace doesn't play like that. It doesn't need us. We like to be needed. It just doesn't need us that way.
Okay, a quick little pause before we jump into Kim's book, Star for Jesus. I want you to know that we're going to touch on some topics in this conversation coming up that you're going to be like, man, I really wish you spent more time on that. So the first thing you can do is buy Kim's book. We've got it all linked up. Actually, did you know we have an entire Becoming Church podcast resource list on Amazon? Everything is there, including Kim's book. But also, you can scroll down in your podcast app to the show notes. And I do this in every episode. So if there are things that you want to know more about how does grace actually connect to control, or what does it mean when Kim says that she just wants to, quote unquote, leave the room? I've got more podcast episodes, messages, and books for you to explore. You're always welcome to share your favorite resources with me as well at becomingchurch.tv or through my Instagram at Kristen Moffler Young. All right, here's the rest of my conversation with Kim. Well, and I also think the first God that I met was a God who needed me to earn his love, to prove something. I always thought that God was like waiting to catch me doing something wrong. And so even though I was a goody-goody, you know, and so that was that, like, I just kind of grew up, again, not because this was what was explicitly taught to me, but because this is what I understood to be true, was that I had to earn, like, yes, God is giving me his love, but really he does want me to be a good Christian. Like, really he does want me to. Did you have that same, like, belief growing up that kind of led to this?
Yes. And I think I, with you, Kristen, my family of origin did not preach that gospel. My parents showed me so much grace. They model grace. Their marriage is a space of grace. Our family was a space of grace. I mean, I'm sure I heard some wonky things at church because church is made up of fallible humans. But in general, I don't think that that was the message I was hearing over and over. That says to me that we are lock in step with every other church mother and church father and thinker from the last two millennia, all of whom wrestled with this. You know, Martin Luther said the default of the human heart is religion. Our immediate reaction to things, especially something that seems way too good to be true, like grace, is to say, okay, well, I'm going to add some rules and some boxes and make this into a system. I think that's just kind of how we're wired, no matter what we are seeing around us. So I don't know. The longer I talk about this book, the more I think about what we've kind of what I've been learning about grace for these many years. I think that part of this is just rooted in our hearts. We can't believe it. And so we don't. Just so stinking good. It's so good to its bones. So that heartens me to hear you say that you too were in a, you know, I don't know that you were getting it from outside, that you had enough of these questions inside. And God is so tender that he knows that about us, right? That's what this is. This message of grace, that grace that sets us free, starts on the very first page of scripture. And he pulls that narrative to the very last. He knows. He knows we cannot remember how good he is, right? He knows. He's very merciful in that. He's way more merciful than I am with other people in my life. Like I tell him something, I'm like, I already said that. Don't you remember that? I've already talked about this yesterday, right? He's so much more patient with me. I'm such a slow study.
Well, and I think again, at least for me, it comes back to control and a task. I need a thing to do. Like you just said, you know, that's we just have to believe and know. And I know that's what faith is. And as a pastor, I probably shouldn't say this, but like I struggle with faith being like just believing. Mm-hmm. Okay, but what? But then what? Like, what's the follow up? Yeah. Like, and then how do I prove that I believe? Like, how do I show you? How do I live it out and act it out? Yeah. And yes, there are ways that we can do that, but it's that just like we just have to believe that God said it, and so it's true and it's great. And I'm like, oh, like okay,
yeah, it doesn't. That we don't do that anywhere else. That doesn't make any sense anywhere else. Like, I can really believe that my, you know. My credit card company is a really great credit card company. They're going to say thank you. And your payment is due on the 15th. So, you know, there's no traction there anywhere else. I think it's more, in addition to belief, I think it's more for me really settling myself in the abundance and the joy that comes with the presence of God, seeking the presence of God. So a lot of the time growing up, you know, if I was involved in a Sunday school program, for example, or a Wednesday night program, the idea was here are the boxes you need to check. And the way you prove that you are doing something for Jesus, and by the way, he doesn't need me actually to do anything for him, but that was lost in translation. Then here are the chapters that you need to read in the Bible, and you need to check them off, and then you come and show your sponsor, and your sponsor will give you a fuzzy Jesus paperweight, which is a lame price, by the way. Even Jesus would say that's a lame price. But if that's kind of the economy of that, I know the heart behind that is to say, little girl, this book is for you. You need to read it. You need to find beautiful things in there. And we're going to tell you what to do and how to do it. And I know that all comes from really good intention, but I mixed up in order to be a good Christian, in order to be the star, that's what I have to do. It has actually nothing to do with being in the presence of God. It has nothing to do with just seeking him, being with him. So that's where we get mixed up. It's not just that belief seems so easy. Because I think belief, honestly, sometimes is really hard.
Yeah.
I think in addition, the point of all of those disciplines of prayer and spending time in the word and being with other people who are difficult, but your family and, you know, pursuing these things together. The point of all of those things is to be in the presence of the God who loves you and to put yourself in his way. You know what I mean? I know he's everywhere, but it's loud. The world is loud. So instead of thinking of those things as boxes to check, what about hanging out with the one who loves you more than any other? When my kids hang out with me, I don't ask them to fulfill a list first. I would never say to my 15-year-old Thea, I appreciate that you want to go out for lunch. However, I need you to prove that you are worthy of that. Right? Here are 6 steps that you need to perform, some of them in silence with a candle. And then I'll decide if that, like that, it sounds ludicrous to us to say that.
Right?
We would never do that. Well, God is a good, actually good parent. He does not say that to us. We've decided that's part of the gig. Not true.
Mm-hmm. You have the best metaphors or examples here, Kim. It just makes so much sense. You're making everything so clear.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I've had to sit with this for a while, Kristen. So I'm still working on it. Still trying to figure it out for my own darn self.
Bring us those good stories. Well, you also connect hope and grace, which hope is another like elusive, sometimes faith concept. Yeah. How do you see hope and grace working together?
I'm still teasing that one out. Very recently, we've had different seasons of grief in our home. And, you know, when scripture says we don't grieve like normal people, we don't grieve as people without hope. That's an interesting pairing to me, that grief would be in the same sentence as hope, because grief doesn't feel very hopeful. Grief feels very much like an end. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's going through just the worst, just so many hard things right now, layers of grief in loss and death and betrayal and longing, like just all of them at the same time. And she said to me recently, I have never understood grace in the way that I have now. She said, grief exposes if you really believe that grace is real. And I thought that was really interesting, that in a time where you can't put one thing with a pretty little bow, that really does make you say to yourself, do I really believe that God has enough grace for this moment? I'm not even talking about later. I'm talking about Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So there's a hope undercurrent in there, right? If we really believe that this is not the end of the story, and that our paid in full, that whole banner of grace extends over our heads for all of our lives and beyond, that's the kind of hope that sticks, right? I've heard people talk about our definition of hope is so rickety in the U.S. You know, we hope it doesn't rain, and we hope we, you know, have a cuter butt by the swimsuit season. Like it's, we use it with like just the, you know, just fluffy little things. But the biblical idea of hope, I've heard it said, is this expectant posture. Mm-hmm. It's something we expect to happen, and we are in the waiting. So that sounds like grace to me. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's something you're waiting for that you deserve or that you earned. You know, I don't hope really for my paycheck. I'm pretty sure it's going to come.
You're expecting.
It's not fluffy. It's not like, well, I hope it comes. I don't know. If it doesn't come, I call the person that pays me. But expecting something that feels like I can't see it yet, but I know it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That feels like deciding grace is real. That feels like deciding, okay, this unmerited favor that God has said I have in him because of him. Okay. I guess I'll decide it's real because I can't even see it with my eyes right now. Right. That's a different kind of hope.
Yeah.
Rooted in grace.
Make it a little bit more tangible.
Totally.
Just hold it right here. Mm-hmm. You also said that we need to have a bespoke grace. Customized and right for us individual. How can people move from, if they have had, to no fault of their own, a very generic, bland view of grace? How can they kind of move into understanding a grace that is tailor-made for them.
Yeah. I love that word. It's very British. Bespoke. Do you own anything that's bespoke? So the word bespoke means custom, like it's made for you. I learned this word in England. And because because these people all over there were speaking in British accents, I automatically agreed with everything they said. And they could tell me anything. I'd be like, yeah, I totally agree. Dinosaurs are still here. Can you say it again? Totally. Here's a phone book. You can read it. I'll just listen.
Wait, hold on. Cannot phone book. Give him a dictionary because we got people that are like, what is a phone book?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Dating myself.
I'm helping you out here for the next interview. No more phone book references, ma'am.
Oh, I'm so elderly. It's so true. Yeah, totally. So I loved the use of this. We would walk down. We went to England a couple of years ago with our kids, and there were advertisements for bespoke suits or bespoke dresses, which these cute little stores where you would go in and nothing is made. You go in, pick out the things, and then they make these things for you. I'm sure it costs approximately a gazillion dollars, but whatever. It's
and a half, I would think.
And a half. Yeah, but great suit. And also never change your body shape because it was bespoke for that moment. There's no letting out of the fabric. But I love this idea of tailor making and making specific to the person, specific to their body type and personality and what they like in color. And God does that with us in the way that he communicates grace. Grace is not a blanket statement God kind of, you know, that he kind of throws out there and says, you know, you all have grace. You all. He says, you, Kim, this grace is sufficient for you. Kristen, this is grace upon grace upon grace for you. It has your name on it. And again, this is not something we see in our normal lives. So we have to retune the way we hear this song. But I think if we do, if we start mining our stories, mining our histories for those times where I think I had to hear exactly that. I had to know exactly that. You see these things popping up that they were exactly for you. That experience, that moment, that interaction, that friendship, that gift, that mercy, that blessing, that was for you. It had your name on it. In fact, a lot of other people might not have even seen that, right? Not have noticed it. That's grace. That's a specific bespoke grace. And it's everywhere. It's everywhere in our stories. We have to open our eyes to it because it's beautiful and we're missing it sometimes.
Yeah. Finding God in the unexpected places is one of my favorite things to do. And so, yeah, right. If we can just open our eyes to God, what are you trying to show me today? And this thing and this movie and this TV commercial and this conversation and this flight, whatever it is. I never thought about connecting it to grace, but I will now the next time that I feel like God pops up in my little life just for me. Mm. Kim, you also introduced us to one of my new favorite words, which is doinks.
I was nervous. I didn't know which one you were going to say. Yep, okay, doinks.
That's a good one. And you said that it is someone who irritates, who clearly cannot figure out the best way to handle a situation or their mouth or their life. So I would like to know.
So trust me, readers. You hear the kindness in those words. Wow. It's so rude.
You're just defining your terms here. But I want to know, because we all listen. Every single person, we already got doinks in our head. We know who they are.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We know who they are. Yeah. But what's harder for you? Is it giving grace to doinks or receiving grace yourself, which is trickier?
Second. Yeah.
Receiving it yourself.
Yeah. I would say, here's the thing about the doinks. Okay. There are different groups of doinks. Kristen, I'm glad you bring this up because I've thought a lot about this. And their entry level doink is someone like who cuts you off in traffic. Okay. We got back from a trip last night and, doinks are everywhere in airports. Okay. Airports bring out really unfortunate things in the human psyche and behavior.
Okay.
So maybe these people outside of LAX were real nice. But once they got into the Los Angeles airport, they forgot everything their mothers had taught them about manners. And yeah, so that's actually entry level, because I will see, we'll call him Stan, in his moment. And I don't live with Stan. Stan's going to Poughkeepsie. Okay. He's had a bad day. He looks rough. He's talking rough. He's super rude to the flight attendant. He's screaming on his cell phone like, okay, Stan seems like a piece of work. I'm really glad I'm not married to Stan, but this is a low investment.
Yes. Go with God, Stan.
Go with God, Stan. And best of all things to you and to Mrs. Stan, if there is one. Okay. Yes. But that doesn't cost me very much. That's entry level. Yeah. AP Doink is someone you see all the time. You work with this person. Your kids go to the same school. You are in carpool lane with him or her. And I want to talk to you about how carpool lane for me this year was a sanctifying process. And I failed. Every morning I would say out loud to my child, why does this person think that they can cut in front and flip us off and drop their kids? How is it possible? And it's not even 8 o'clock in the morning and I'm feeling like, oh my gosh, the justice.
We have a map. I'm like, follow the map.
It's a map. We all have the same information. Okay. So that's AP. That's AP because you're going to see her again tomorrow at 7:59. Yes. Yep. So I feel like that is definitely you're related to these people, right? They're at Thanksgiving, and by the way, I also am on my own principal doink. I know there are people in my family and in my circle who are like, "Wow, Kim's coming, huh?" Okay. So, they're like the interpersonal relationship, or interpersonal relationships do present absolutely this Everest to climb. And before I leave that and we talk a little bit about extending grace to ourselves, I do want to say out loud that we are laughing about the carpool person, but there are people in our lives, sadly. And often they're people who say they know Jesus who can wield that word as a weapon, and that is not actually the meaning of the word. So I want to be clear that sometimes that word grace has been used to bludgeon, not to heal.
Yes.
Right? Yes. We have heard that word used in interpersonal relationships that are abusive or harmful. Folks have said, well, all you need to do is extend grace to that person who is hurting you. And I want to be so clear that that's not grace. That is not the meaning of that word. You as a doormat, you as a punching bag, your heart or brain or body as something that is manipulated and used, that there's no grace in that room. Grace turns on the lights in the room. Doesn't turn it off, right? Doesn't put some blanket over everything and says, oh, no, it's fine. Look over here. So that's a very quick – I always feel I need to say that because I have been alarmed at how many people have reached out and said, thank you for the chapter on what it's not. It's alarming to me that that is a story that so many can tell. So I want to make sure that that's clear. It's not a pass for unkind, bad, abusive behavior.
So what do we do before you answer the part about receiving grace for yourself? Because we all know highly irritating Jesus people.
Yeah.
Obviously. I'm not one. You're not one. Our listeners are not, obviously.
Sure. Right? Of course.
We're all exempt here. But we all know them. We all know highly irritating Jesus people. So how do we deal?
And you're saying irritating, not abusive. Correct?
Correct.
We say that. Okay.
Correct.
I don't know.
Of the doink
I mean,
nature, not the, yes.
The doink. Yeah. My first thought is to make sure I am absolutely beginning my day in a space where I'm remembering who I am. So if I'm taking the time, for me, it's morning to look into the face of Jesus and say, oh, yeah, that's right. I've got a little doink in there myself, don't I? And his face is one of complete compassion. And I always, I always think that he's kind of laughing a little bit. I know that's my bent, but I know he's very patient with me. So if I start with that, right, and I start with, gosh, our mutual friend Nick Connolly talks about time with Jesus being GPS, talks about gratitude, prayer, and scripture. And if I begin my day with gratitude, it's going to be pretty tough for me to face outward to my life and be like, well, you know, I kind of just earned all of this by myself. That's a no, right? When you start thanking God for what's yours and most of it you didn't even do a darn thing for, that helps your posture towards difficult people. Mm-hmm. And then I'm a fan of leaving the room. I'm serious. Like, my mouth gets me into trouble. And so I wish 25 years ago, I would have had the courage to say, you know what, that is such a great, I'm so appreciative of your perspective. I need to think about it. I mean, this is in parenting too. We do all sorts of damage by staying in the room. Give yourself a little break to leave. Yeah. We don't all have to be besties, right? In our house, we talk about, I know you have daughters too. We talk in junior highs when we start talking about female friendships.
Honey, we started talking about that in the fourth grade.
Yeah, that's the truth. Really, it was first grade that we had our first issue. So we talk about the concept of junior high dance friends. I made this up. Okay. I have absolutely no idea if it's helpful to anybody else.
Bring it. I want it. I want it all.
Okay. So there, you can have a few friends. You should have one, two friends, just like your heart friends. They get all the stories. They get all the honesty, all the vulnerability. You guys laugh at the same jokes. Like, it. That's what makes life rich and palatable if we have one or two of those people. You don't need 40 of those people, which is the lie of junior high. Most people are not your heart friends. Most people are junior high dance friends. This is the visual. Remember junior high dance? Where
straight arms, don't bend your elbows.
Straight. There's some healthy distance. You don't actually even look at each other because eye contact feels like nakedness. You barely touch. So awkward. But for those 2 minutes of dancing to Footloose, here I am dating myself again.
Boys to men. It's okay, we're
boys to men. Boys to men. The cleaner versions, not I'll Make Love to You, which was the final song at the prom that I chaperoned as a high school teacher. That's another story.
Oh my God.
A different version of Boys to Men. You're there together in the moment with these folks, but they're not, you don't have to hold them to yourself. And that, I think that's a healthy workplace question too, church place question. Like, not everybody gets the keys to the kingdom. Not everybody gets the microphone or the megaphone. Not everybody gets like the red carpet of, please tell me how you think I should live. That's actually a really small group. And we get confused when we think that we need to have everybody in our inner circle. Let's do a little bit more junior high dancing.
Yes. Well, we are coming close. This has gone so fast. We're coming close to the end of our time here, but I want to go back to if there was anything that you wanted to say about giving yourself grace and why that was difficult and how for other people who maybe also find that difficult, what you've learned.
I learned the most helpful lessons about extending grace to myself once I started having babies. And I saw how I was a lot kinder in my language to my children than I was in my head to myself. I would never, ever say out loud to my children some of the things that I've said to myself about who I am, how I look, what I do, what my worth is. And none of that's coming from the God who loves me. None of that's coming from my parents. That's all my own little situation I've drummed up for myself. And I would never talk to Anna, Mitch, or Thea like that. Never. Yeah. In fact, if someone else did, I'd probably punch them. I would be so, I mean, really, if a teacher said some of those things, I would be like, okay, we need a meeting. We need to talk to the principal. And yet I let that tape play. So it's helpful to me to think, would I ever say this to Ani? No, I would not. No, I would not.
Yeah.
So giving yourself the same bandwidth and the same compassion that you do to someone you love is a great place to start.
Yeah. And I was going to say, even if you, for people listening that don't have kids, it can be somebody else in your life or even your own personal inner child. Yeah. You know, Mary Van Geffen gets my personal DMs often where I'm like, oh, little Kristen needed this. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, if you don't have kids in your life, think about
anyone
your own
who loves you
child.
And you love them. Yeah. The person in your life that just absolutely lights up when you walk into the room, that person.
Yeah. Well, Kim, because the podcast is called Becoming Church, the last question that I have for you is how can people listening become the church to the people around them?
The way we knew better. Okay. We can always do better. So, and also I say that with a ton of compassion. Right. There are a lot of things going on all the time for all of us. So maybe the first step is a big, deep breath before you walk in any door and remembering again, oh gosh, we've all had a lot of days that led to this day. So reaching out with that kind of posture from the beginning to people around us. I think a lot of the way that we become a church that more beautifully reflects the God we serve is a looking back. And I'll tell you what I mean. I think there's this thread in scripture over and over that God says, remember, I'm the God who saved you. Remember, I'm the God who pulled you out of slavery. Remember, I'm the God who dried up the Red Sea. Remember, remember. And if you read scripture like front to back, you kind of start to think that God has a memory issue that you're like, yeah, you already said that like in every book. And that obviously is quite intentional. We do ourselves a favor when we remember. And so I think a lot of problems pop up if we come into a space or to a relationship or to a room full of people who know Jesus or don't know Jesus yet. And we think, well, it starts now. Did not start now. It did not start now. All the things started long ago. And to have that front of mind and for ourselves to be looking back in our history and looking for, mining for, where is the faithfulness of God? Where is the faithfulness of God? And then what that does, this is how the church is so compelling. And it was from the very beginning. And I've been reading about and thinking about those first few decades after Jesus ascended into heaven, all these totally clueless people were set with this mission of like, go change the world. Also, you don't know. I love thinking about them because I think, you know, we look with this like, you know, kind of, oh, and that's, you know, a little bit of a, not a superiority, but we have our total, you know, backseat drivers. We've got this in print. Yeah. They have no idea. What I love about that is that the story, and I know I'm a writer, so this is so predictable, but the story is what got out. The story is what propelled the narrative. It was not a bullet point plan. It was not some doctoral thesis that only five people could understand. It was the story of a carpenter from Nazareth that changed the world, changed little worlds and big world. So that's our story as the church, our big story. And also we have these mini stories of, again, that specific bespoke grace and how we have seen it in our lives. And so if we tell that story, that's the most compelling narrative ever. People can't look away. They can't look away. We're not tapping into that resource enough. Tell your story, the bigger story, the best story, the story of grace, and also how that looked in your own lives. You don't have to convince anybody. Our friend Bob says, people don't bring people to Jesus. Jesus brings people to Jesus. You can get rid of that job. He will do it. You just tell your story.
Yes. But I think remembering that we are not actually the hero of the story. God is working incredible things in our stories, and we should share them. But when we can remove ourselves enough to realize it's actually God's big story, and He's invited us all to be part of it.
Unbelievably.
That perspective alone shifts everything.
Unbelievably. All the least likelies in the room.
Yes.
If we get to be a part of it.
Starting with
me. Coolest thing ever. It's the coolest thing. It's not over yet. It's the best.
Right. Well, listeners, I hope this has been so fun for you. Please, please go get Star for Jesus and Other Jobs I Quit. You will probably cry. You will definitely laugh. And Kim, this has just been such a delight. So thank you so, so much for being here.
Oh my gosh, the honor has been mine. Thank you so much, Kristen.
We do ourselves a favor when we remember what God has done. What a beautiful, beautiful thing for Kim to just say. That's actually my prayer for you as you listen and go on with your day, that you would see God moving and let the memories of his faithfulness carry you through until you see him moving again. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, keep becoming the church to the people around you.